WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cowain. Ward Just covered Vietnam for The Washington Post, and more than most reporters, he caught the absurdities of the war. David Halberstam said this about Ward Just: perhaps no reporter wrote as well from Vietnam with as much subtlety and grace as he did. But Just began to question whether the larger truths of war and politics got lost in the details of daily reporting. Eventually, Just lost his taste for journalism, and he quit the Post to write novels. Herbert Mittgang in the New York Times writes, Ward Just left daily journalism some 20 years ago, and lucky for lovers of distinguished fiction, turned his talents to novels and short stories. He is one of the few modern journalists who has leaped the wall between the two crafts successfully. He has emerged as one of the most astute writers of American fiction. Ward Just lives in Paris now and has just completed his latest novel, The Translator. It's the story of Sidney Van Damme, a German who lives in Paris, where he works as a translator. Van Damme's father was an officer in Hitler's Third Reich. The book explores a theme that Just has written about before, the loyalty between fathers and sons, and a son's responsibility to his father's past.
Sidney Van Damme happens to be exactly my age. There's no particular reason for that, except it's easier for me to get the time sequences straight. He's 55. Mm-hmm. Look at a German who's 55. It means they're born in 1935. 5 years old when the war commenced, 10 years old when the war ended. No complicity in the Third Reich. A five-year-old can't have a complicity in that. And yet, the consequences of that, the burden of memory, the weight of history, are borne by the youngsters. They're borne by people who were not complicit, but must live with the consequences. This is not true not only in Germany, but for the rest of us. You're always bearing the consequences, often, of things that you neither started nor finished, but somehow the consequences are yours, and that's what struck me as interesting about Sidney.
Well, I think what's difficult for a child, as you say, that is truly a child then during World War II, is that you're right, he lived in Germany. He wasn't the architect of German's policy, right. But he had parents. And in this case, he had a father who, although he wasn't a Nazi, was part of the regime.
A staff officer in the Wehrmacht.
Well, it's an impossible task you've set out for this.
That's right. It's just excruciating. And Sidney's solution to it was to simply expatriate himself from Germany and go to live in Paris. And one of the things that the book spins around are these terrible arguments that he has with his mother, who is a very tough woman indeed, who believes that when you leave your country, you lose your soul. She says to live in a foreign country is a terrible fate. She believes that you uproot yourself. You no longer can no longer live in the way that you should. You have no more roots, and you're sort of floating free, and nobody cares about you. When you become inconvenient, you will be thrown away, she says.
Is this a kind of a theme that you've been playing with in a number of your novel? I'm thinking of The Ambassador, where a father has to sort of choose between a son and his country. In Jack Lance, a father is sent to prison for tax evasion.
Yes.
That somehow children have to try to not answer for their parents, but sort of do have to answer for their parents.
Indeed, and in the case of the Ambassador, that's a trick that goes both ways, because in this case, it's not only the sins of the father visited upon the son, but vice versa. And that was the way I was trying to set that up. I've always been, in all my work, I've been interested in people who are dislocated, who start off one place and end someplace else. But the one thing that they've got to begin with is the rejection of the native ground.
Are countries then, in a sense, surrogate parents?
Yeah, I've always had a thought. I've often looked at it the other way around, that a family is a kind of a surrogate country. I've always had a thought that a family, if you think about a family, it really does have its own sort of laws. It has its own economic policy. One family's economic policy will not be another family's economic. It has its own language. It has its own cuisine.
its own territory.
It's own territory, which it defends or not, depending on the case. So I've always thought of it like that, and I've thought of it more that way than the other way around. But the other way around is also true.
I'm wondering in this book whether you're trying to make a connection between the kind of guilt that both America and Germany feel towards their particular past and even towards their particular wars. The reason I ask that is that Sidney Van Damme has a past associated with Germany in World War II. His wife is trying to recover from the fact that her brother was killed in Vietnam.
Yes.
And whether you feel, and Vietnam is a war that you covered, whether you feel that these two countries, America and Germany, share some kind of guilt about the wars that they have fought.
I think that this is true in a larger sense. I think that we all live in a political context. Any American lived in 1980, in the 1980s, was different than the way they lived in the 1950s, and in part that was because of Reagan. That you lived in a different way because of the political context of the times. In the more specific case of these two, the Vietnam War was not the monstrosity of the Third Reich. These are not equivalents. But it was bad enough, and it was a depredation, in my view, so outside the sort of normal the parameters of American behavior over the years. Not that American behavior has always been that wonderful, but this seems to me to be quite a departure.
You covered Vietnam
yeah.
For the Washington Post in, I think, 67, 68, 69?
66 and 67.
Your report seemed to have an eye and an ear for the kind of absurdities of the war.
Yeah.
That seemed to be what you noticed there. Were there some writing lessons then from being a war correspondent that influences your writing as a novelist?
Yes. The extremity of a combat situation, the violence of it, the look of it, the human consequence of it, it seems to be so important. It is such a profound event that you feel a tremendous responsibility to the material to get it right. Not to fuss around with it, not to in other things, in political correspondence, you can get a little cheap from time to time. You better damn well not be cheap in a combat situation when you're writing. There just seems to be too much at stake, and it, in some strange way, I think it teaches you responsibility to the craft somehow. Because it's so important. It's not some nitwit on the stump, you know, giving some stupid speech. This is the real thing. People are dying. And as you try to describe the nature of a battle, you better damn well get it right.
But can you get it right? And you seem to have come back from that war with a deep suspicion of the facts.
Yes.
And there's something that you say, I think it's in your novel, Jack Glantz, the truth was a forest of facts, and the facts were in the shadows. And if you could describe the shadows, you had the truth.
Yeah. That's what I truly believed, particularly about war correspondence, that there's a way to describe the atmosphere of violence that did not depend on getting the name, rank, and serial number. It depended on the off quote, not the quote that was going to tell you how many meters were advanced that day, but the quote that somehow got to the underbelly of the situation. And frankly, you could do a lot with quotations. I mean, interviews, you could, if you're trying to describe something, you can move the thing a little bit from here to there. But the principal thing was a description, getting the description of the terrain right, and particularly the attitude of the deaths. I had a particular task when I was there. I was working for the Washington Post, and And I knew damn well that whatever the common reader might think about these dispatches, they were also being read in the Pentagon. And I had I felt an absolute responsibility to let them know as they were moving pins, their little pins forward on the maps, exactly what that was doing in the front line. So I sort of took it upon myself to get as far into that, as I could, and try to write it as well as I could without. I never used novelistic techniques. Mm-hmm. I don't think you have to. It isn't necessary in an atmosphere of that kind of violence. The material is so rich. You don't have to stretch to describe it the way it ought to be described.
You were wounded in that war. Mm. You were hit by shrapnel,
yeah.
And I believe you were with a platoon or a company,
yes,
that many people died around,
yes,
you, and certainly,
yes, yes,
were wounded. Do you still have shrapnel in you,
yes,
from,
yes,
that war?
Yes, it extrudes from time to time, little tiny little bits and pieces. And it will, I mean, it, you know, sort of forever. It was, you know, kind of a shredded situation. But it's no big deal. It just happens.
My guest is Ward Just, and he's written a number of novels. His latest one is called The Translator, and Ward Just is a former Vietnam correspondent and was a journalist in Washington, D.C., both writing for The Washington Post. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Ward Just is my guest. I'm wondering, as a journalist, and even the way you talk about war coverage, I feel like there still is a journalist inside you somehow. When you see the events of the world happening, I'm thinking not just Eastern Europe, but certainly the Soviet Union and even the war in the Persian Gulf, whether part of you wants to go out and cover it.
No. I get an offer from time to time. Somebody, you know, why don't you go back and do this or do that? And I don't have much confidence anymore in my ability to separate the fact, the objective fact of the thing, as opposed to sort of what I think about it. And for a newspaper, it isn't important what I think about. I mean, a newspaper reporter ought to have the fact. I mean, you use your words kind of as this. That's the clear pane of window glass that you can see the animals inside. I mean, then that's what the words are, the glass, and the animals are inside, and you're not creating wavy lines, and you're not using colored glass here and clear glass there. The whole thing has got to be clear glass. And I don't have any confidence in my ability to do that, and I'm not eager to do it. I don't, you know, a lot of friends of mine, because I hang out with a lot of newspaper people, were down in the Gulf. And I thought, God, what an awful assignment. I mean, not only is there no Bordeaux at the end of the day, but there are no facts either. I mean, there's no story at the end of the day except what some colonel is telling you. So,
well, let me quote you to you.
Yeah.
And this is and this is an article. Actually, it was in the U.S. News and World Report a couple of years ago. And this is talking about journalists in Washington, but I think you seem to be talking about journalism in general. You say, more often than not, Washington journalists deal with an event as if it were a loose football that everyone piles on. There's a huge pile on a tiny fact while the ball squirts here and there. With all the journalism that's been done on Richard Nixon, for example, there's still a piece of his psyche missing somewhere, and it will remain forever mysterious until some latter-day Shakespeare creates a character much like him that will somehow explain Nixon to us. What you seem to be saying is that fiction can somehow get to the truth easier than journalism can.
Well, it's interesting. I don't often believe what I said in the past, but as Ben Bradley would say, I'll stand beside that. We know as much as we know about Nixon. Only because of journalism, because of the work that's been done over the years. From the very earliest days of his career, 1946, that's how long he's been with us now. Mm. We only know what we know because of journalism. With any of us, there is this piece missing. You, me, you know, who, George Bush, Jimmy Carter. There has to be. Otherwise, we're all just kind of robots. Mm. And I think that what happens is that somebody will create a character, and his name will not be Richard Nixon. He'll call him something else, And this character will be drawn in such a way, and it, maybe it'll come in 100 years or 50 years' time or 20 years' time. Those of us who are alive and sort of knew Nixon in the early days will say, my God, that's it. That's what he was like. It's not him. It's the shadow of him, but the outline drawn so well that you say, all right, that's what it was.
Can I ask you about your smoking?
My smoking.
Well, let me tell you what I want to ask you about that, because...
Why would I do such a thing to myself?
No. I'm not here to reprimand you, but to talk about the difference between smoking in this country and smoking in France.
The country seems to me to be obsessed with cigarette smoking. You get on an airplane, and there are about 5 announcements. I mean, you know, stop smoking on no smoking materials of any kind. Don't even think about smoking in the John, because there are smoke detectors in the airplane.
And we'll come
will
and
stop
arrest you.
And people will come and arrest you, and you'll be thrown in the jug 2 to 10 in Danville, making license plates and the signs, thank you for not smoking. Please don't smoke. Don't even think about smoking here. It's just a damned cigarette. I mean, it's not as if you're trying to commit murder. Going to get a lot of letters.
Yeah.
Going to get a lot of letters over that statement.
But do you find you sort of have to sneak around in this country?
Oh, yeah.
and that you're kind of a pariah? I mean, no one wants to talk to you or sit next to you?
That's right. People are very... I mean, I have some dear friends who we'll be having dinner, you know, and with a tremendous sigh. They're very nice. They're very nice to do it. They will put down an ashtray next to my place, and they'll say, all right, the dinner's over, light them up if you really feel you must. And as you know, in France, people love to smoke. They do nothing but smoke. Americans go to France now, and the tourist bureau is not going to like me for saying this, and they're appalled because the French restaurants don't have no smoking sections. French smoke like chimneys all the time, during meals, between courses. There's one guy who loves to eat at a little restaurant than I do. He always eats there alone. He smokes between bites of his of his cassoulet while he's having a little wine along with it. It's a kind of a freer, you know.
Well, I think in this country we say this man has a disease. Disease of addiction.
In this country you say this man is addicted. He's committing suicide. That is too funny.
Well, have you ever tried to give up?
Yes, I got hypnotized once.
Did it work?
I worked for a month. The physical consequences were so disastrous. I will not go into all of them, but the physical consequences were so disastrous, I said, to hell with it. And that was 10 years ago. I probably will try it again in some more serious form, because I'm getting to the age where you probably shouldn't smoke as much as I do. But by God, I sure do enjoy it. That's what I do when I write all the time, you know, 2 packs a day.
About
2 packs a day. Camel straights.
The hard stuff. That's,
if you're going to do it, you might as well do it, right?
Well, Wardjus, I really enjoyed talking with you today.
The very same.
And I thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Wardjus' latest novel is called The Translator.